Caroline, you're very welcome to the podcast. Caroline, maybe for our listeners, you could tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get to this point? Why sales? Just share with our listeners a little bit about who Caroline is.
Sure. Well, thank you for inviting me on, Paul. Do appreciate it. My background originally is big corporate. So I cut my teeth in a strategic consulting environment where we were both selling and delivering projects to large pharmaceutical companies all over the globe. So it's very much a professional services background, many years in that environment. And then for various different reasons, got to the point where actually I felt like I wanted to specialize in a particular area in more detail, had a natural interest in sales, felt like, although I'd been doing quite a lot of sales, I felt like there was more room for improvement, both in terms of personal skill, but also processes and systems. So was very interested to get introduced to Sandler and find a lot more about actually, if you like, best practice really about how to do sales. And for me, it was then a no-brainer really to get involved in Sandler as a business.
So you were in professional services in project delivery before you got into sales. Was that correct?
Yes, there was a sales component too. As you got more senior in the consulting environment, then you got involved very much in selling. We're talking enterprise level sales here. And a lot of it, to be honest, was learning on the job. A lot of the challenges that I see clients struggling with are exactly the same ones that I struggled with as I went through my career and, you know, really had to figure out how do I overcome those to become even more successful.
So what would you say then were the big picture struggles, the obstacles you came up against as you transitioned from your first role into a full-time sales role?
Gosh, almost too many to mention. The first one really was not knowing what I was doing. So as I think isn't atypical within professional services, you got to a certain level of seniority and were then expected to take on a business development target and start to grow that. And really, there were no particular processes or systems in place, no particular guidance of how you do that. You were just, if you like, you know, handed this target and then good luck. So for me, it was really starting from a blank sheet of paper and figuring out, well, what's the best way to do that? I fell into all of the very typical traps of, I think, very traditional sales in terms of not always having peer-to-peer relationships with prospective clients, thinking that had to do whatever it was that they asked. I mean, certainly in the world we were in, there were a lot of RFPs that came, requests for proposals that came our way. And we would just jump at every chance, to be honest, and not really take a qualifying approach. So we're wasting a lot of time and effort and energy.
I'm curious because there's a lot of material out there that you read on RFPs that will talk about how to qualify, how to avoid getting into those traps. And I'm just wondering, from a company corporate point of view, what was the belief system? What was the culture that led to the practices you're talking about?
I think the belief, and I've seen this across many different professional services firms, was that actually you had to respond to everything, that actually in a way you'd be almost insulting the client or the prospective client if you didn't respond. Even if you knew you had very little chance of winning it and it wasn't really within your sweet spot, there was certainly an expectation of that. You potentially would cause offense. So therefore you would burn your bridges with that client if you didn't respond.
Yeah, it's something I've often heard as well expressed as, oh, we need to do it for the relationship or we need to do it for strategic reasons. Mm. I'm wondering if that's more a rationalization for investing time, maybe at a gut level, knowing that you may be wasting it, but you have to be able to rationalize why you're doing it. And is that the case, you think, or is it just, you know, a simple case of pure fear that if I don't do this, I may lose an opportunity that, again, at another intellectual level, you probably know is not all that strong?
I think it was really coming from the latter one, to be honest. I think it was a genuine fear. But also, I think that was partly driven because I think within that industry, for the more established companies, they're used to getting these RFPs in. They're not so used to having to go out there and open doors and create new opportunities. So it's almost like if you shut off the ones that are coming, the opportunities that are coming your way, well, there's a risk that something else won't come in instead. That's really where I think it was coming from.
That makes sense. Makes sense. Tell me something. I saw a presentation you did, Caroline, on sports psychology. So I'm going to make the assumption that mindset in the game of sales is something that is important to you. So maybe you could share with our listeners how you came to that place in your journey where you're now focusing on mindset. And then maybe you could talk a little bit about the sports end.
Yeah, well, sports psychology is something that I find absolutely fascinating. I guess I've always been fairly sporty, got involved in quite a lot of sports throughout my life, and have always been interested in watching and following, a range of different sports. And I guess I've always been intrigued by the mental differences that make some people highly successful and other people fall by the wayside. And I guess what I've increasingly realized is that there are such strong parallels between what's going on within sports psychology and what really applies for us in business, in sales specifically. There are so many different components that I think you can break down sports psychology and take lessons from it. I mean, part of it is just even this principle of building muscle memory in the technique that you're using in a sales environment. So, I think of sales as being this, we should be approaching sales as this idea of continuous improvement. How can we be making incremental improvements that add up to making us significantly better? And I guess that's a principle, we've all heard that being talked about very, very extensively across sport, that idea of marginal gain, which has particularly been talked about by Dave Brailsford. I think it's ensuring that we're applying that principle to ourselves so that we are, as I say, continuously getting better. But in order to do that, we've got to know, well, what are the core techniques? What are the elements that we need to consistently be getting better at? And then breaking that down into sort of smaller components that we can then practice and work on and do role play, so we're getting better all the time, and then adding all of those components together to build that muscle memory, so that when you find yourself in a situation with a client, maybe it's where you've got to have a tough conversation with them, you've got to really plant your feet, that muscle memory is already embedded mentally, so that you can just drop straight into applying that technique, that approach, if you like, really effectively.
Yeah, it's an area that fascinates me as well, and I wonder how many parallels do apply, and I'll tell you why I say that. You talk about sports people and muscle memory, and I fully understand that, and in fact, I was having those thoughts this morning. I was practicing piano. It's exactly the same. You have to practice, and it's all muscle memory, and it's a frustrating experience because you're making mistakes, and you have to go over and over and over again. And As I think about that, I'm wondering, first of all, you have to have a really strong reason and a strong drive to want to do that. And I'm not so sure I always see that in sales. And also, I was reading a biography by one of my favorite sports people recently, and it struck me the obsession he had for continuous improvement. But at the same time, a lot of that obsession, or a lot of the motivation, I guess, came also from the manager he reported to. And there I saw a distinct difference between sports and sales, in that the manager has a panel of 20 players, can put 15 on the team, maybe a bigger panel, 30 players. And so therefore players are fighting for their place. The manager in an organization doesn't have that luxury of saying, okay, you're not playing today, you're on the subs bench. And therefore, there is an advantage. There's a way of motivating sales or a sports people to perform at their peak. that you don't have in business. And then going back to my other example of the piano, well, that comes from within. That has to be something that you're motivated to do, that you have a passion for whatever reason. And so therefore, when you take those apart, I'm wondering, where are the areas where you can motivate salespeople to not just perform consistently, but also to invest in growing? And I'm just curious to know from your experience, what are the kind of things you've seen where when you don't have that internal passion, or you don't have the manager who can change up the team very easily, what options do you have?
I think part of it comes back to, do you have the right people on the team in the first place? One of the metrics that Clive Woodward, who used to manage the England rugby team, talks about is, do people have a sponge mentality or a rock mentality? So people who've got a sponge mentality are inherently driven to want to learn. They're fascinated by whatever their sport or their subject area, if you like, or their area of expertise. They're fascinated by that and driven to want to learn, driven to want to get better. So that's that, if you like, that kind of innate drive. And then you've got people who have that rock mentality, and they're very closed. So I'm sure everyone who's listening will have encountered people who've got that rock mentality. They think they already know it. They think they're as good as they need to be. They're not open to doing things differently, and you're very resistant to new ideas. And I think if we can continuously, as we're recruiting, making sure that we're only bringing in people who have that sponge mentality, that sponge mentality brings other people on board and brings other people to drive themselves, I think, to be even better. And if you have a leadership team, or at least the sales manager who also embodies that sponge mentality, is always about growing, developing, learning more, improving their game, I think that lifts everybody. And certainly in my experience, that can make such a big difference in terms of the internal motivation of individuals, whether they fall into that sponge or that rock mentality.
That would seem to me, though, Caroline, to put an awful lot of put a great pressure or emphasis on the manager to almost be a psychiatrist or a psychologist when they're hiring somebody to be able to figure out, to be able to identify whether somebody is a learner, whether they've got that sponge mentality or not. What are the kind of things you would say to a manager who may be going into an interview situation tomorrow and listening to you is going, okay, I need to figure out, you know, are they learners? What would they look for? What kind of questions do they think you could be asking?
Well, I think part of it is recognizing that interviewing is not always the most effective way of evaluating people's mindset and abilities. I mean, clearly it plays a role, but you know, there's been various bodies of research that have been done that basically say interviewing is essentially guessing. You may as well put your finger in the air. And yet we tend to put a lot of stock by it. So I would always advocate having an objective process as an early stage part of your recruitment process that helps you to get under the skin of that person to be able to objectively evaluate, actually, are they a learner, as well as many other different components about their levels of ambition and drive, for example, so that you have an objective measurement of that. You're not just going on your gut instinct around it. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say that I'm wondering here is if it's a case as well of like hiring like, in that if you're, as a manager, you're a rock, you're a fixed mind, you're certain in your understanding of the world that you're going to hire. You first of all, you're going to be threatened by somebody who's a learner, but B, I think your ego is going to require that you hire somebody in your likeness. And I think the same may be true of managers who have the sponge mentality, that they're going to see the world differently and therefore going to hire people who share their values. And I'm wondering, is there any evidence for that though?
I think only anecdotally, to be honest, but it just intrinsically makes sense. I mean, you're right. I mean, why is a sales manager going to bring somebody in that makes them feel uncomfortable, that they're being challenged, that might highlight to other people their more limited mentality of like in terms of being very rocky. I mean, I agree. I think there is a risk that they would screen that person out, even though they actually might be the perfect person to bring into their sales team to inject it with some energy, some change and some growth.
So I'm guessing then maybe the first person you have to screen or at some level assess when helping people hire and recruit would be the manager. What type of individual are they? Okay.
Absolutely. Never thought of that one. Yeah, no, absolutely spot on. Because in many ways, they set the tone or the culture for that team. I mean, you could even argue you need to go a level higher as well. Do you need to be looking at the leadership team as well and the culture that they're embedding, which might then be filtering down, if you like, to the sales manager and then down to the sales team. So yes, I think if you're looking to change the sales culture you've got with an organization, you always have to look at the leadership before necessarily assuming all of the challenges, all of the things that are not working are down at the level of the sales team.
Makes perfect sense. So tell me, come back a little bit to when you made that transition into sales, mm-hmm. into full-time sales. You obviously learn a lot about sales in terms of how to qualify, how to prospect better, etc. What did you learn about yourself?
Oh, so much. Great question. Yes, I suppose the biggest thing that I realized is that I had a lot of beliefs that were limiting beliefs, what we call within Sandler head trash. So those beliefs that you've got that essentially get in the way of you doing what needs to be done. And in my previous role, I guess I'd been in that for a while. I was very comfortable knowing what it was that I was doing. You know, there were a lot of things that were, you know, challenging me and causing me to grow, but it was quite a shock, I suppose, getting into a sales environment and then suddenly realizing that there was an awful lot more mental change, if you like, that I needed to go through to become even more effective. So, you know, coming from a professional services background, you know, the idea of doing prospecting on such a regular basis, well, that was, you know, so opposite to the culture that I'd grown up in, that was, you know, a really big change that I had to get my head around.
So when you think about the self-limiting beliefs that you had, which one did you feel was the most difficult to overcome, and how did you overcome it?
I think the biggest one for me was that fear of failure. So not doing a behavior or an activity because of what might go wrong. I think that's a very easy one to duck the things that make you uncomfortable. But pretty quickly, it was very clear to me that if I didn't change that belief and address that, then, you know, I just simply wasn't going to be successful within any type of sales role. So for me, it was really about working on affirmations and journaling. So really about working on getting my mindset where it needed to be to help me to overcome those self-limiting beliefs and get my mindset where it needed to be so that the behavior change became an automatic transition from that point.
So for people who might, when they hear the word affirmations and journaling, and might feel that was a little bit American.
Yes.
Tell me about your journey with that. Were you skeptical to begin with? And if so, what did you experience? What did you learn as you went through the process?
My goodness me, I was the greatest skeptic known to man. I come from a science background originally, so everything being very evidence-based. And when I was first exposed to this idea of journaling with the affirmations built into that, honestly, I looked at it and I was like, well, that's just the biggest load of nonsense I've ever heard of. There's no tangible evidence that works. Really and truly, that's not for me. Can't see why it would make any difference. It took me a little bit of time to get over that. But so what I then started to do was, well, I was like, okay, well, maybe I can't dismiss this if I haven't actually given it a fair crack of the whip. So I started to do it, but because that was still my underlying mindset, I was really sporadic about doing it. But actually, the breakthrough came for me when I figured out that So at that time I was doing a lot of running. And I had a tendency, I suppose, to at times find the running really tough, you know, when I was training for particular events and really having to push myself. So I thought, well, it'd be really interesting to try this journaling, these affirmations, and see, can I get it? Can I use it to help me improve my mindset when I'm running so that I, if you like, I'm embracing the pain and just being much more positive in my approach to my running. So I did that in the build up to an event. I probably did it for about 3 months continuously. And it was astonishing, the results that it had. It really made such a big difference to how I viewed my training. I was starting to get significantly better results in my running. And that led through to me enjoying the event that I then did much more than I ever would have done previously. So coming out of that, that then gave me, the cynical me, more evidence that actually there was something here. And from that point onwards, I've done it absolutely religiously. And I wouldn't be without it now, to be honest.
So could you give maybe our listeners a sense of the kind of affirmations that you feel have helped, and maybe talk a little bit about the frequency or you know, best practice in how to do this for anybody who's sitting on the fence and says, I'd like to try this, but is going to do it in a sales context?
Yeah, so there's a particular structure that I follow with my journal. I mean, there's so many different variations out there. There's some really great apps that can help you support you to do it. But if I just talk you through the one that I follow. So for me, I'm doing it on a daily basis. I only do it weekdays. And the structure that I follow is to define. So I'm writing this down every single day. I'm writing down what is the annual goals that I'm working towards, what is my monthly goal for that month, and what's my weekly goal that I'm focusing on. I then do 10 things that I'm grateful for, writing that every single day. And let me tell you, that was extremely hard to come up with 10 initially. I then write approximately 10 things that I want to attract, so things that I want to happen in the short, medium, long term that I'm working towards. I have a very short section, which is about my commits, which is basically the must-do things that I will do that day that will move the business forwards. And then I write my affirmations. I think the number of affirmations you have is entirely personal. Mine's probably somewhere between 8 and 10, I would say. And the kind of things that I have within my affirmations are either mindsets that I'm still working on embedding within myself, or mindsets that I've got, but I want to make sure they're front of mind the whole time. So an example of one of those would be that every day I outbehave the competition, which means that I'm the most sought out and sought after sales consultant in East Anglia. That's an example of some of my affirmations. I have another one, so I have personal ones in there as well. So I'm really working on my swimming technique. So in there I am a highly effective and efficient swimmer.
Okay.
So that's not necessarily true at the moment, but it's definitely something that I'm working on in that spirit of continuous improvement.
Yeah, I guess it's living that fake it till you make it, and that you have to see it as part of your personal identity. And when you see it as this is who you are, I guess then you're motivated to live that, to behave that, because anything else is like a fire under your ass. I don't know if that makes sense. That if you believe, for example, that you're a highly efficient swimmer, then that leads you to think differently about swimming, but also about yourself, and therefore how you see yourself affects how you behave. And I'm just wondering, what we're doing really is programming our own beliefs about ourselves as much as we are about how we see the world.
Absolutely spot on. I think until we get our mindset in the right place, it's difficult to sustain that change. I'm reading a fascinating book at the moment. It's a very old book, but it's called What to Say When You Talk to Yourself. And it's basically all about this concept of, if you like, training your brain so that your mindset is setting you up to be successful so that, if you like, everything else can then follow off the back of it. And it's really about recognizing what it is that you say to yourself, the kind of language that you use to yourself, the language that you use out loud and the language you write down. So affirmations are a very core part of that. But I think what that book suggests is actually we need to go further than just writing down the affirmations. It's also being aware of, are you living that, in the sense of are you constantly reaffirming those affirmations when you're talking to yourself or when you're talking to other people? Because there's a disconnect there. I don't think just writing the affirmation down will really get the change people are looking for.
Yeah, it's an interesting point that if you really don't believe it, you can write it down all you like, it doesn't make a difference. And so therefore, maybe the trick is to write something that you can believe in. So, you know, I my example on this one was when I started training for a marathon. I never saw myself ever running a marathon. That was beyond my horizon of believability. Just, I was a couch potato, and that the longest I'd ever run in my life was 2 miles. And that was probably 20 years prior to when I started training. And for me, I started with a 5K because I believed that was doable. Now, I couldn't do it at the time, but I believed it was achievable. Whereas if I tried to, you know, I would run a marathon in under 4 hours, or, you know, I could have written that all day. And I don't think I really, really would have believed it. I think somewhere it would have been filtered out where I could say I can do 5K in half an hour, for example.
I think you're so spot on. So it is very tempting to want to write down those huge affirmations that are, you know, the greatest that we can conceive that, you know, somebody could do. But if your mind, every time you look at that, just rejects it, it's too big. So you're right. It's breaking it down then to a level that's pushing you beyond what you're currently doing, but your mind can still wrap its head around that. So for example, the affirmation I talked about, you know, that I'm the most sought out and sought after sales consultant in East Anglia. Well, I could say I'm the most sought out and sought after sales consultant in the world, but at the moment my brain can't get around that. So writing that down is not a helpful affirmation to have in there. So you're absolutely right. You've got to tailor it. So it's pushing you a bit, but it is still within the realms of what you can conceive and believe in.
I think I'm going to start with that affirmation myself, but I'm going to limit it to my cul-de-sac in the housing estate I live in.
I think you could definitely go further.
Okay, maybe phase one houses in my estate. I want to ask you a little bit about maybe looking towards the future, that there is a narrative out there that today's buyer is different. I'm not so sure I really subscribe to that view. I think buyers, you know, are humans, and humans, we haven't changed all that much in terms of what motivates us. I think there's a lot of different tools out there. There's different ways to reach buyers, but I don't think the buyer has changed. But that's my view. I was just wondering what's your view on it, and what I guess what I want to ask you is, what do you see that hasn't changed? And what do you see that is changing or has changed?
I think the fundamental thing that I see that hasn't changed is that buyers are wary of salespeople. And I don't think that's going to go away in a hurry. And I think that's what leads us into a lot of the challenges that people experience within sales. In terms of the areas that are changing, I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I guess, you know, certainly within Europe at the moment, this whole idea of the legislative change around GDPR, I think that's going to drive some behavior change within sales and sales teams. Be interesting to see how that plays out. But I think that's going to force people away from what might be a more comfortable way of doing prospecting, which is to reach out to people via email, and is going to force them to find other ways, or go back to, if you like, maybe less fashionable ways to start conversations with prospects. So by that, I mean really picking up the phone. You know, and you see an awful lot on social media these days, people saying cold calling is dead. Well, I mean, I fundamentally don't believe that. And I think we're going to see quite a growth again in that area with the onset of GDPR.
Yeah, there's a few things there I'd like to talk to you about. I guess I wanted to start with the last one because it's something I've seen so often over the years is how people form beliefs as a way of rationalizing their discomfort. So I'm uncomfortable making cold calls. So therefore, if I form the belief that, hey, they don't work, then I can get away guilt-free with not even trying. And it's not just in that domain. You see it in others as well. But come back to me about GDPR, because this is only on my horizon. It was actually a client said it to me recently in a large technology company. They do a lot of prospecting. And he said it's something that they're, I won't say they're scared about, but they're certainly focused on and worried about, because you're right. I think it's going to change practice. But I asked him, so he said, like you said, Caroline, he says, you can't just email anybody now. But I said, can you send an email? And he says, I think so. And that to me then would just, the behavior will say the same. It'll just be a different channel. Everybody will be emailing. And I'm just wondering, will it have the same effect, or will people find a loophole? I just wondered what you've heard, what you've seen.
I mean, I agree with your client. I think there will be an increasing amount of activity that we see on LinkedIn. People using that as, again, a way that they feel more comfortable with to avoid doing cold calling, picking up the phone. I think the challenge is going to be, though, that will become a very crowded marketplace, and how you can get people to respond to emails. I think, you're going to run into exactly the same problems as you potentially do with emails. But also, with my understanding of LinkedIn, you can only send an email to one individual person. So you're not going to be able to do the mass emailing that some businesses really rely on to do their lead generation. So I think you're absolutely right that people will still resist the idea of picking up the phone. But I agree. I think it's much more of a mindset piece and a belief. And they rationalize that it doesn't work, or it's no longer an appropriate way of doing business. That, for me, comes back to that self-talk thing we talked about before, the affirmations, that the first thing you have to do is work on your personal affirmations around picking up the phone in order to become more effective and more consistent at doing that behavior.
Yeah, I think what people miss out on when it comes to cold calling is just how important it is to train hard on getting good at it. And because you're up against a lot of barriers. It's not just a technical barrier. It's not like, for example, learning to play the piano is a technical barrier. Just requires practice and effort. But if you put it in, you're guaranteed you're going to be able to play. Whereas with cold calling, we have a lot of sociological barriers. We have this evolutionary thing, this fear of rejection, the discomfort that comes with not necessarily being welcomed when we speak to somebody that, I'm going to say most people have, because it's a very human trait. And getting people to overcome that, or not even overcome it, but be comfortable with it or be willing to push through it, I think is going to be a huge challenge for people, because it's harder and harder to get people on the phone. So therefore, when you do, you have to be really good, really good. I think maybe 40, 50 years ago, picking up the phone was a novelty. And therefore, I think it was easier to get to talk to people. I'm not so sure. I'm just curious to know where it's going. I don't know, but I'm curious.
Yeah, I think that's entirely fair what you're saying. And I guess part of it is ensuring that it's one part of your prospecting mix. That not all your eggs are in one basket, that, as a general rule of thumb, we talk about the fact that you should have a minimum of four different types of prospecting activity that you're doing on a weekly, monthly basis. And then throughout the year, adding in two, three more different activities that maybe happen on a less frequent basis, things like trade shows. So if you've got your cold calling as one part of that, that mix of four activities doing on a regular basis, then, even if you don't have the best technique at it, something you're still refining, it still gives the opportunity to be generating leads through other activities as well.
Speaking of prospecting activities, I see on LinkedIn that you're now doing video on LinkedIn as part of your prospecting mix. How's that going? What, maybe you could talk a little bit about what motivated you to start doing that, and what are you seeing as a result, or is it too early to say?
It's pretty early days, to be honest. But in terms of what motivated me to do it, part of it was in terms of building awareness, if you like, building awareness of myself, of Sandler, within my local area, but also to share practical hints and tips with people that they can use to improve sales for them, whether that is them doing sales on a day-to-day basis, whether that's them in a sales leadership role. Part of it was to impart. I think we've got some great tools, great techniques, great thinking within Sandler. And part of my motivation was to want to share that with people in kind of bite-sized chunks, if you like, because, I mean, you know, there's so many good books out there, but, you know, there's a limited amount of time that we've got, and to sit down and just digest, you know, lots of business books. Well, not everybody's able to do that. So yeah, it was really those two motivations. One, to, you know, build brand awareness in my area, and to share more hints and tips with people.
Very good. A couple more questions for you, Carla, before we finish up. If you were to write a book on sales, what would you write it about? What would be the theme of the book? What area would you want to add some value in to the debate?
I think it would be around some of what we've already talked about. This idea of the mental aspect of sales, drawing in some of those parallels that I think there really are with sports psychology, and really looking to help people to manage that mindset and get it to work for them more effectively than maybe it does currently.
Okay, interesting. And if you were looking back to younger Caroline who was just entering sales for the first time, what advice would you have for her?
I think it would be to start journaling right from the word go. Don't be so cynical about it. Embrace it. And you'll see the results. You'll see the transformation for yourself.
Makes perfect sense. Caroline, regrettably, I could talk to you all day, but we're up against the buffer on time. How can people get in contact with you if they want to get in contact with you?
So they could either do that through LinkedIn, just search for Caroline Robinson on LinkedIn. You'll find my Sandler profile there, or drop me an email, crobinson@sandler.com.
Excellent. Caroline, I really enjoyed our talk today. Thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful, the words of wisdom that you've been able to share with us. Thanks once again.